Welcome to Role Playing History, the podcast where we explore the history of role playing games. I'm Wayne Davis, and I'll be your guide for today's tour. Episode 145, Car Wars and Crystallicum. This week, we're going to take a look at two games that couldn't be more different from each other, Car Wars and Crystallicum. So while I could do my usual banter filler here, and since I'm doing role-playing history episodes every other week, I've certainly got the time to do it, let's just cut the bullshit and get the tour bus cranked up and get to the first topic on today's tour, shall we? Car Wars is a vehicle combat simulation game developed by Steve Jackson Games that was first released in 1980. The basics of the game are that players control armed vehicles in a post-apocalyptic future. But you know me, we've got to dive a little bit deeper into the history of the game. Inspiration for Car Wars has repeatedly been cited to be Alan Dean Foster's 1971 short story, Why Johnny Can't Speed. And the game itself was initially presented in a small Ziploc bag format, which is how we saw a number of these miniature simulation games in the late 1970s and early 1980s. It should also be noted here that later editions of the game noted that Harlan Ellison's short story, Along the Scenic Route, and the movie Death Race 2000s were noted as inspirations for the game, so I suppose we should consider all three sources inspiration for Car Wars in totality. And speaking of editions, I'm going to break down the various editions of the game in a bit, so if you're curious about that, just keep on listening. As the game became more popular, there were a series of increasingly more expensive and elaborate editions. Car Wars also served as the inspiration for the 1985 video game Auto Duel, which was published by Origin Systems. And even after all these years, Steve Jackson continues to express an interest in developing video games based on the concept of Car Wars. However, Car Wars experienced a serious slip in popularity in the 1990s, and as that happened, Steve Jackson Games stopped supporting it. The last official material published for the original version of the game appeared in Pyramid Magazine, and that was an article introducing high-torque mortars, which was written by Robert Dice. During the period the simulation game was out of print, however, Car Wars wasn't completely dead. Auto Duel America, which was the setting for Car Wars, was developed for various role-playing games using the GURPS setting from Steve Jackson Games. And for the record, that particular world book saw two separate editions and a series of expansions for both the GURPS version of the game and the board game, which was called the AADA Road Atlas and Survival Guide, and those were published in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Now, as we've learned over the history of this show, when a game has had the level of popularity that Car Wars experienced in its heyday, it tends to have a revival, and Car Wars is no exception. By the turn of the century, fans of the original version were clamoring for the return of the game, and Steve Jackson Games listened. In 2002, the company released an entirely new version of the game. Redesigned for a new audience, it was called version 5.0. The marketing for the new version of the game has been noted by most game experts as unusual, as it was scattered across multiple redundant products. It wound up being met with mixed responses, and thus the popularity once again began to wane, and the reason for that is that the game was created for a new audience who just didn't seem to get it. However, Steve Jackson Games hasn't taken that 2002 material out of print. In October of 2009, Steve Jackson Games made the Car Wars Compendium 2nd Edition, 5th printing, available as a PDF from the E23 online store. Car Wars in both the board game and PDF versions have been translated into French by Croc. And backing up on the timeline a bit, Car Wars the Card Game was released in 1991. It was designed by Creed and Charlene Lambard and published by Steve Jackson Games. It got a second edition in 2001. All right, so I promised we'd take a look at the various editions of Car Wars, so let's do that here. And I'm going to do a little something different than what I normally would do. Typically, I just mention how many publications came out in each edition and I'd move on, but I'm going to dig a little bit deeper here, and I'm doing that because each edition and each publishing within that edition adds different pieces to the game, and some of the editions make more changes to the moves. So, in the interest of being thorough in my reporting, and since we've got more than enough time, we're going to get a little bit deeper than we've gone in the past. And I do want to note as a brief overview that the first four editions of the game use a ground scale of 1 inch equals 15 feet. Aero Duel introduced an air scale of 1/4 inch equals 15 feet. Fifth edition uses a revised scale of 3 inches equals 15 feet. So those are the basic rules. Let's expand. The first edition, which ran from 1981 to 1984, is the edition that came in the 4 inch by 7 inch Ziploc bag, or later on the pocket box. It had cars, pickups, vans, and motorcycles, and turns in the game had 10 phases. The 1982 supplement Sunday Drivers Crash City, which released in a pocket box, added pedestrians, a small bus, and rules for buildings. The 1983 supplement Truck Stop, also released in a pocket box, added full-size buses and semi-trailer trucks. Also released in 1983, Auto Duel Champions was an actual book that checked in at 8.5 inches by 11 inches. It added helicopters, grasshoppers, which by the way are flying cars, and superheroes, which were technically not canon for Car Wars. It also introduced an alternative hex-based movement system that used 3-inch cars and 1-inch hexes, and that was intended for use with role-playing games. For the record, this system was not used again in Car Wars. That being said, the scale is the same as Car Wars 5th Edition, so just note that. 1983 also brought the Car Wars reference screen, which was a 3-panel screen that measured 8.5 inches by 11 inches and introduced an advanced collision system. The final 1983 release, and the final release for first edition, was the AADA Vehicle Guide, another book measuring 5.5 inches by 8.5 inches. This added trikes, those are 3-wheeled motorcycles, and off-road rules. Moving on, we get to second edition. That brings us to 1985's Car Wars Deluxe Edition. That released in a 9-inch by 12-inch box. It combined and refined all of the rules of first edition rules and added 10-wheeler trucks. Also, it should be noted that starting in 1990, these books had the Car Wars Compendium 2nd Edition rulebook instead of the original Deluxe Edition rulebook. So if you're checking your box, you can have an idea of when your box came out by which rulebook you've got. 1986 saw the release of Dual Track, which was a 9-inch by 12-inch box. It added gasoline engines, metal armor, race cars, and chassis and crossbows, which are rules for the primitive early history of Car Wars. 1987 brought the AADA Vehicle Guide Volume 2, which was a 5.5 inch by 8.5 inch book that added sedans and campers, which we would now call SUVs. 1988 brought Boat Wars, which was released in a pocket box. When it was re-released in 1990, it came out in a 9-inch by 12-inch box. Either way, it added boats, amphibious cars, and hovercraft. That was the final release for 2nd edition, so let's check out the only release for 3rd edition. That was 1989's The Car Wars Compendium, which was an 8.5 by 11-inch book. It reduced turns to 5 phases and revised the control table. It also compiled all of the 2nd edition rules, short the race cars, into one place. It also refined car movement and based it more on the turning key than on a map grid. That leads us to the last edition of the original release, and that was 4th edition. 1990 brought us Car Wars Compendium 2nd edition. That was an 8.5 by 11-inch book. It revised the control table once again and revised the rules, including race cars, and added lots of updates and refinements. That book was reprinted and re-released in 1996 in the same format. 1990 also saw Car Wars Tanks. That was a 9-inch by 12-inch box. It added wheeled military vehicles, tanks, and some really big guns, because let's face it, we like really big guns. 1990 also brought Aero Duel. That was a 9-inch by 12-inch box that added fixed-wing planes and airships with both civilian and military-grade weapons. The final release for the original version of the game was 1992's Uncle Albert's Catalog from Hell. I have to admit, I like that title. It was an 8.5-inch by 11-inch book, and it included all previously published construction rules, weapons, and equipment. But the only play rules are minor updates to the CWC 2E rules. Fifth edition had a single release, and it was 2002's Car Wars 5.0, which was 9 comic book sized pamphlets, which contained the same rules with different car designs, any one of which were all you needed to play. It went back to just cars, and all of those were pre-designed. The rules were simplified, and the turns were reduced to 3 phases. The scale was changed to 1 inch equaling 5 feet. And as of 2011, there were no official construction rules. Now, I know I didn't mention this before, but I should note now, there is a 6th edition, though I had a hell of a time trying to dig up details. Here's what I do know. On November 29th, 2019, a Kickstarter was started to create that edition, and it was fully funded as of January 6th, 2020. 3,936 backers pledged $652,995 to bring 6th edition to life. And if by chance you have a copy of this, hit me up, give me the deets about it, and I will bring all of that up in a future episode. So, those are the details on the various editions of Car Wars, and thank you for sticking with me through all of this. Again, I normally wouldn't go into that deep of a dive on the various editions of a game, but with all of the additions and all of the expansions for Car Wars, I felt like we really needed to do it. And again, thanks for indulging me. Also, I do have some more things that I would usually add in a section like this, but since we just did this huge info dump, I think I'm going to do that after we cover the gameplay, so it gives us a section and a minute to kind of catch our breath. Now, before we talk gameplay, I think we need to do the setting, as it were, for the game. Car Wars is set in an alternative future when natural resources are severely depleted and the United States government has nationalized oil production. This eventually led to a second American Civil War, ending with the secession of the free oil states. Those are Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. Following famine in various parts of the world, there are limited nuclear exchanges between the USSR and the US, but anti-missile systems limit the resulting damage. After these wars, there are years of worldwide economic crisis and related global unrest, during which death sports become a popular form of entertainment. This post-apocalyptic setting has drawn comparisons between Car Wars and the Mad Max movies. As things began to recover, the organized sport of auto dueling was born as a form of armed demolition derbies. The American Auto Duel Association, or AADA, was formed to sponsor sporting events and up-and-coming auto duelists. In this future, technology has allowed for new vehicle designs, miniature weapon systems, and replacements for internal combustion engines. Furthermore, human cloning, together with techniques for storing memories, has made death only a minor setback for auto duelists who can afford the procedure. Car Wars is a game designed for simulating these auto duels between competing players. Okay, so we've laid out the story. The basic idea is that this is a miniature war game, as you figured out by the story, the history, and from the description of the various editions of the game. And regardless of the setting being used, that's what this is all about. The players are directing their vehicles in combat. Each of the published games are using cardstock counters to represent vehicles in a simulated battle on printed battle maps. And on the larger map scales I mentioned earlier, some players used miniature toy vehicles like Hot Wheels or Matchbox cars because why not? I mean, most of us had them, so why not use them if we could, right? Car Wars uses standard dice to determine the outcomes of weapons fire, damage, and vehicle control during the game. It's played in turns, with each turn representing 1 second of real time. Each turn was initially divided into 10 phases, which was in the first edition, then 5 phases in the revised edition, and by the final edition, 3 phases. And for the record, all action in Car Wars is simultaneous. Players do not roll for initiative. Instead, in each phase, a vehicle moves a distance determined by the vehicle's speed. Players may fire weapons on any phase as long as they have line of sight with a target of their choosing. As part of movement, players may attempt turns and other maneuvers of increasing difficulty. The more maneuvers one attempts in a turn and the more difficult they are, the more likely it is that a player's car will skid or crash. After all phases of movement and combat are resolved, a new turn begins. Typically, a game is over after a few turns, which represents a combat of a few seconds, but because every action in the game must be resolved, a typical game takes a few hours to play. While the core of the original Car Wars was a board game, the supplements allowed it to be extended into a larger game with light role-playing game elements. Other expansions, such as rule editions, mini scenarios, and dual-statted products like Auto Duel Champions, published in game magazines, expanded the game even further. Now, I mentioned there were a few other items I wanted to mention earlier in the history section, and let's drop those in here before we get our reviews in. Car Wars had an official organization to support it. The American Auto Duel Association, or AADA, was a worldwide group of players. It was started by Steve Jackson Games, who supported the club with a quarterly magazine called Auto Duel Quarterly. This contained campaign ideas, vehicles, mock advertisements, and new weapons and accessories, as well as questions and answers. Subscribers would receive a bonus in the form of an extra cutout or cartoon on the protective mailing cover. Local clubs could also pay a yearly membership fee to be considered official. The AADA served as a structured clearinghouse for common rules and guidelines to be followed during official events. World championships were held each year at the Origins Game Fair. The AADA is no longer an official club as recognized by Steve Jackson Games. There are still several local clubs that claim to be AADA affiliated, and there are even websites where interested parties can enjoy PBEM games. One site even has a Car Wars podcast. The official Car Wars site notes plans to relaunch the AADA and start a new periodical called Auto Duel Times. However, no date is given for the launch of this project as of our broadcast. Now, I mentioned the spin-off video game Auto Duel earlier. In addition to that, Epic Comics published Car Warriors, which is a four-issue comic book miniseries in 1991 that was set in the Car Wars world. There were also a series of six game books based in the Car Wars universe, where a player could make choices for the protagonist that would affect the outcome of the story. The Car Wars Adventure Games books were titled Battle Road, Fuel's Gold, Tool Track, Badlands Run, Green Circle Blues, and Mean Streets. A trilogy of novels was published by Tor Books, The Square Deal by David Drake in 1992, Double Jeopardy Car Warriors 2 by Aaron Alston in 1994, and Back from Hell by Mick Farren in 1999. Okay, so we've covered a lot of Car Wars. I think we're at the review point, and I've got two. We'll start with John Lamshed, who handled the review for the March-April 1982 issue of Phoenix. He reviewed the first edition of Car Wars and said it was, quote, quite decently presented, end quote. He did say, though, that the simultaneous move system was, quote, excruciatingly tedious, end quote. Overall, he noted, quote, a combination of intelligence and immaturity is required for a full appreciation of Car Wars, end quote. The November 24th, 1989 issue of the Chicago Tribune called the game, quote, vicious combat that takes place on the highways and waters of the future that is not a kinder, gentler America, end quote. If you're interested in checking out Car Wars, head over to the Steve Jackson Games website, sjgames.com. Now, normally I've got a few words of commentary about a game that I'll make here, but rather than encouraging you to play, which, I mean, I do, instead I'm going to address why I included Car Wars in today's show, since it's more miniature game than role-playing game. Car Wars has been a game on our request list for several weeks, and I've been looking for a spot on the schedule to squeeze it in, and I decided that this week, with the need to extend the first episode of the alternating episode rotation, I decided this would be the best spot to include it in. Maybe that was the right choice and maybe it wasn't, but I'm always saying that if you request the topic, I'm going to make it a point to cover it on the show. So That's why Car Wars was a topic on today's tour. And for those who asked for it over the past month or so, I hope I covered it to the extent you were expecting. And speaking of requests, I think we need to move the tour on to the second topic on today's tour, which is also a multiple time request. Crystallicum is a Polish role-playing game released in 2006, and it's set in a fantasy universe, which provides it with magic and other fantasy role-playing elements, but it also has an outer space environment, so if you're looking for something comparable, think D&D's Spelljammer setting. Not exactly, but close. And by the way, the artwork for the book has a very manga feel to it. I never say that word right, so I'll say it both ways. For those who are into collectible card games, there is a game of the same name that was actually released before the role-playing game, dropping in 2005. It is set in the same universe. I'll expand on it momentarily. And while I usually have a ton of background on our games and their designers, I am at a serious disadvantage this week thanks to my inability to read or speak Polish. And since I don't trust Google Translate due to the issues it's given me in the past, I'm going to go the safe route here and pass on the information I was able to dig up that's all in Polish. If you're someone who's really good at translating Polish to English and would like to share with me, hit me up. I'll do a YouTube exclusive to follow up on all of this. What I can tell you is that the role-playing game consists of what's called the Known Universe, or Znany Wyświat in Polish. I know I screwed that up. That is a guide to the game's setting written in the form of the memoirs of Marco di Mirandio and a player's handbook titled Crystallicum Crystoe Gra Fabularna. I'm going to have a hell of a day with this today. There was a point in time that rumors were out there that the role-playing game was going to cease publishing due to at least one of the authors leaving and taking the copyrights with him. But it turns out those rumors were false and publishing has continued on. For those interested and or involved with the card game, it consists of the Crystallicum Crystal Edition base set, otherwise known as Crystallicum Edge Crystalwa, as well as two expansions, Underset Sails or Pod Chelmi Zaglmi, and Stronger Than the Sword or Snedzesi Od Mieska. It's been reported that a second edition of the card game has been worked up, tentatively titled Crystallicum War of Shadows or Crystallicum Wojna Sienni. It's been talked up on the game's forum repeatedly by several people affiliated with the project, though an official release date for the project hasn't been announced. Okay, so that's the history I've got for this week. However, I'm going to make up for the lack of history with a ton of setting material. So for those who asked for the game, you will be getting the amount of material you'd hoped you were going to get. So just don't worry here. The game features a number of planets for the GM to use as a setting for your party's adventures. And since quite a number of maps depicting formerly charted space have been lost, new ones can be added as anyone wishes to do so. In game, they're called worlds, as the term and name planet is reserved for a single world, which is considered to be the center of the universe. In between the worlds, players find what is called the void. Now, the void isn't what you'd expect, though. It's most assuredly not empty. It contains a breathable atmosphere, as well as a habitat for a number of species, mostly but not exclusively based on fish. The temperature of the void seems to be higher than that on some of the worlds. Gravity on the void, or would that be in the void, seems to work most of the time, but the issue of where is up and where is down, yeah, that hasn't really been established. While you're on a ship, down is towards the deck. When you fall out of a vessel, though, you more or less hurl through the void until you, or your corpse, I mean, let's be real here, get caught by a world's gravitational pull, or a ship stumbles upon you and decides to take you on board. Also, the card Ingenious Maneuver, also called Blitzaufwe Manur, features the following flavor text, and I'm going to try to do the Polish first, then the English translation since I found it in both. Of course, as I've been doing all along, I'm going to probably butcher the Polish, so let me just apologize in advance. Widzniałeś, przecież plakniem wydol, nim miałem projekle, z tol mnolwe, Luciano de Vela. I apologize. I screwed that up 9 weeks from Sunday, I'm sure. Let's do the English. I'm way better at that. Did you see that? He flew with his deck upside down. I had no idea it was possible. Luciano de Vela. Good Lord. I'm having a hell of a day. The Great Void is a vast stretch of the void surrounding the known universe. Due to the lack of planets or even substantial rocks, preventing placing even a small resupply point for ships, it has for a long time been an impassable barrier, and the object of many tales regarding what, if anything, lies beneath. Recently, however, Cristobal Quintabera y Natalia Salazar de Vela, the Dragon Prince, ruler of the Dragon Dwarves, led an expedition meant to traverse and see what lies beyond the Great Void. The card game expansion Under Set Sails takes place after the return of the expedition, proving that there are worlds inhabited by until then unknown races beyond the Great Void. The role-playing game is a bit unclear on its specific time placement. While the Great Void is mentioned as impassable in the player's guide, the known universe ends with the protagonist telling the news of the Dragon King's expedition's return and deciding to travel to the newly discovered lands. All right, let's talk next about the Red Moon. It's a unique celestial body, and it travels between worlds in a somewhat erratic yet possible to predict pattern. Astronomers have devised ways to establish the Red Moon's course, and some people are born with the innate ability of sensing its comings to the world they are on. It's the scourge of all beings, as whatever living thing is basked in its light mutates both physically and mentally, becoming a raving monster. By the way, the term monster in Crystallicum applies only to the victims of the Red Moon, be they a sentient race, animal, or plant. All right, let's talk crystal. I mean, it is in the name, after all. It's one of the most widely featured extraordinary substances in Crystallicum. It's found on all worlds except one, and that one is the planet. It develops under the Earth's surface and therefore is mined and extracted. The crystal has numerous uses. After being set in a special socket, it can bestow the socketed item with special or magical properties. It can be used as a battery for crystal-based weaponry. Crystals power the void-faring ship's engines. In fact, they power many more or less mundane devices, usually fitted to the crystal's elemental manifestation. They are also an integral part of focuses. These are items characters with magical abilities use to perform their magic, since a crystal fit to be set in a focus is both rare and valuable because they can't be worked in any way and must have developed the right shape naturally. Though they come from beneath the Earth, most crystals require sunlight to fuel their powers. A crystal that has expanded its energy takes more or less 30 hours in the sun to recharge, half the time if it's recharged in the void. Other, more effective means of recharging a crystal do exist, however. Crystals do develop an elemental affinity according to the nature of the world they came from, so let's break those down a little bit. We're going to start with air crystals. These are translucent crystals which destroy light, creating tiny rainbows all around them. These are found on cold and windy worlds. They are affiliated with the mind, genius, and deception. These crystals can increase one's perception, cause a chameleon effect, outright invisibility, cause an item to glow, allow a weapon to fight on its own, or bestow the ability to fly, and that makes them the power source for world-faring ships. Next up are earth crystals. These are dark green crystals found on worlds with a rich flora and fauna. They're affiliated with energy, life, and power. They can cause additional wounds on a successful hit, increase a character's strength or dexterity and agility, make the character more resistant to wounds, imbue it with the power of regeneration, or repair broken items. They also have a distinct ability, which is that they can store twice as much energy as other crystals of the same level could, which makes them the most common choice where a crystal is used only as a source of power, for which the best example would be machines. Fire crystals are, as you'd expect, glowing red crystals that are found on dry and hot worlds. They're affiliated with the untouchable sphere of life that is luck. Fire crystals can cause darkness, allow one to see in it, drain elemental energy used against a character, increase its luck or speed, or cure diseases. Fire crystals have the most straightforward manifestation of power among crystals, which makes them widely used in healing devices, weaponry, and in ship engines naturally. One element left, and those are water crystals. Those are dark azure crystals found on worlds with high humidity. Those are the worlds that have a lot of rivers and lakes, vast seas, regular downpours, or are shrouded in perpetual mist. Water crystals are affiliated with the spirit, relations between beings, and all things ever-changing. They allow the weapon to deal poisoned or stunning strikes, pass through an opponent's armor, let the character comprehend languages, shapeshift, or strengthen its will. These crystals are rarely used for non-magic purposes, partially because their powers are the most enigmatic and least known. Crystals can also hold spells within them. The crystal's affinity has to correspond with the type of magic it's supposed to hold, and its size must also be sufficient. Once in a crystal, a spell can be released by anyone simply by shattering it, making it a means of access to magic for non-spellcasters, or for spellcasters to have a quick spell ready for dire emergencies. The obvious downside are the single-use nature of such items, as well as the fixed nature of a spell contained within. Now, there's another substance we need to discuss here, and it's called overmetal or nadmetal. It's another extraordinary substance, and it's one of the things that differentiate a common character from a hero. The substance, also mined from beneath a world's earth, can be used to make weapons, armor, and items of extraordinary durability and high quality. However, its true value shows when used by characters who resonate with overmetal. It then grows with the wielder owner, increasing in power, gaining abilities, and changing its appearance to reflect his or her power and character. By default, all player characters resonate and start with an overmetal item, which is known as that character's overmetal heritage. One of the benefits of possessing an item crafted from this ore and resonating with it is the possibility of having special slots for crystals in it, which imbue the item and or its owner with additional powers, which can be called upon when needed. A crystal placed in an overmetal item does not need sunshine, instead drawing upon the owner's life force to recharge. Recharging a crystal in such a way usually only takes a few hours. There's one more thing I wanted to cover in this particular section of the breakdown, and it's something called the gift. Simply put, the gift is the ability for a character to harness their magic ability. All right. If a character isn't born with the gift, they'll probably never be able to use magic unless some extraordinary circumstances come about. In fact, there are some tales out there that the prophet was not able to use magic until he returned with the crystal hand. A character's gift is dependent on his or her race, and it cannot be changed. To tap into it, aside from training, a focus is required. A focus is a specific item, which is tied to the gifted player's race, with a special crystal set within it, and its affinity is also tied to the gift that holds no power aside from channeling magical energy. The study of magic is divided into paths. There are universal paths, which are available to every race, focusing on the harnessing and use of magic, and race-specific paths, which allow the channeling of specific effects. A gifted character also has better control over spells contained within crystals. The attitude towards the practice of storing spells this way differs from race to race. The Ice Elves combat the practice of capturing their spells in crystals for use by anyone of not Ice Elven descent. The Dwarves, on the other hand, with their utilitarian approach to magic, have no trouble selling crystals with their spells within. Attitudes towards gifted ones are as different as the worlds themselves, and on some spellcasters are born elites, on some they are revered. Other worlds hold spellcasting as just respectable professions, while on other worlds the gifted are outright hunted. So we touched a bit on races towards the end of that last bit, and while I'd like to do a really deep dive into the various races of Crystallicum, again, I'm limited by my understanding of Polish. I did manage to get a pretty decent amount of stuff on the Ice Elves and their cultures, so let's take a deep dive into how they appear in the game. And I'm going to try the quote from the card game thing again, but this time I'm going English only because this bad boy's a long quote and I have no confidence in my Polish to try the whole thing. Sorry. There do not exist boundaries which cannot be passed, spaces which cannot be traversed, nor wonders which cannot be comprehended. It takes only for us to extend our hand and we shall reach the stars. Alexandrios Megas. That's one of the basic philosophies of the Ice Elven Dominion, which is also known as Cesartuo Lodwich Elfo. I also wanted to note up front something that's a major deal for the Ice Elves, and it's the Path of the Mind. It's their focus. And while it's called a bracelet, it resembles something more like a glove that's worn on the right hand. It has an air crystal set in the palm, and as it grows, it climbs up the forearm, and its over metal threads form more intricate lines and patterns. The hand part, though, doesn't change quite as much, especially the part that's on the palm. That part stays flat the whole time, which makes this particular focus unobstructive in nature, and that allows for a weapon to be wielded in that hand effectively. So, yeah, it's a pretty damn big deal. Now, since we mentioned the focus, we need to break down the faction, since we know that in pretty much every role-playing game, races or cultures tend to be broken down into subclasses, sub-races, or subcultures of some type. Now, in the case of the Ice Elves, this breakdown is into coteries, and since these were originally established by the Kaiser, who is the head of the Ice Elves, and it was done so to augment his power. Each coterie has some purpose or specialization, and while not all of its members are solely devoted to it, it can be reasonably expected for a member of a coterie to be reasonably knowledgeable or proficient in his or her intended role. As time changed, though, some coteries dissipated while new ones have been created. Also, some worlds with only a marginal Ice Elven populace are known to still have coteries whose members are tied only by being members of it, with no focus on a skill or role whatsoever. So the known coteries include, but they're not limited to, the Dicastrio Coterie. Now, it focuses on political influence. Most of your diplomats and ambassadors come from this. Now, originally, it was meant to strengthen the Kaiser's political influence on the conquered worlds, but with the decline of the Dominion, its members have started doing their little political games within the Dominion itself. Most of the Kaisers in recent history have come from this coterie, and even today, when the formal Kaiser is Irene Dasma, its influence on Ice Elven politics in the form of Gerasimos Pagos, well, it can be pretty strongly felt. Let's talk about the Dioxy Coterie. Now, this is a relatively new coterie. It's only a couple of hundred years old. It was formed sometime after the gnomes opened up for trade and services. Its purpose is to search the universe for the crystals containing Ice Elven spells and repossess or destroy them. Also, if said crystals happen to be owned by a gnome from the Guild of Gloves, that said gnome, yeah, he's gonna be ready for a very slow and painful death. Next up, it's the Crystallos Coterie. This is a coterie devoted to the study and practice of magic. Most of its members are gifted, however, there are some who only aid in the theoretical aspect of studying magic. I mean, in some cases, they usually just focus on the gifts of other races. Now, while not all gifted Ice Elves join this coterie, most gifted members of other coteries have discovered their abilities after leaving the nursery. Due to the nature of the Ice Elven gift, this coterie is both feared and revered even by other Ice Elves. Let's talk about the Naftis Coterie. This is a coterie from which most ship captains in the Dominion come from. Its members are expected to be masterful captains and fleet commanders. The current Kaiser, Irene Dasma, hails from this coterie, and since she's been brought up to be a ship captain most of her life, she runs the Dominion just like she'd run a ship. The Pra-Pizzo Coterie. There we go. Created for a single purpose, waging war against the dwarves. Even though the Ice Elves lost the war against them, this coterie has not been disbanded and its members are still active, though their role has shifted towards instigation and sabotage instead of outright conflict. However, if there's a clash between dwarven and elven forces, this coterie, yeah, they're going to be the shit disturbers, so that's where you look. Those are your coteries. I really wish, after we looked at the Ice Elf stuff, that we had more on the races. I can lay out even money, though, that if we had more information, we'd be able to break it down just like this. Now, I got one more piece of research for Crystallicum that I wanted to drop on you, and it is a timeline I was able to piece together through all the stuff I dug up. So if you would indulge me, I thought I'd give you an idea of the highlights of the campaign world of the game. We are going to actually start in Year Zero. Year Zero is the rise of the Ice Elven Dominion. Alexandrios Megas, the leader of the Ice Elves, finishes a long-lasting campaign aimed at subjugating all the inhabitants of his homeworld. After destroying the last focal point of common elven resistance, he assumes the title of Kaiser and declares the beginning of a new calendar, which will become the chronological base for most of the known universe. Soon afterwards, Alexandrios moves to conquer other worlds in the universe. How he came to possess technology allowing him to traverse the void, and why did he fixate himself on the fact that there are in fact other inhabited worlds, remains a mystery even today. Year 1 to Year 500. Glory of the Dominion. The rule of the Ice Elves extends over more and more worlds. For their inhabitants, the invasion of the Kaiser's army is the first contact with any race hailing from outside their homeworld. The borders of the Dominion expand quickly, and with it comes cruel slavery on the one hand, and a great technological and cultural progress on the other. The propagation of interstellar travel, writing, or a code of laws not dependent solely on the whims of a ruler are just some of the things most races owe to the Ice Elves. Year 287, Time of the Red Moon. From this time comes the oldest known written account regarding the appearance of the Red Moon, which eclipses the sun, turns animals into raving monsters, and causes sentient beings to succumb to a murderous fury. From the writing's tone, however, one may assume that the Red Moon existed earlier and that the Ice Elves had to deal with its effects before. Year 502, The Discovery of Estonia. The Ice Elven fleet reaches the borders of the Federation of Estonia and, for the first time, encounters a race aware that a multitude of worlds exists. Nevertheless, the Kaiser spares no time in waging war, which turns out to be disastrous. The invading fleet is all but decimated, and the elves suffer their first defeat in the history of the Dominion. Rancorous, the Kaiser orders to destroy all accounts regarding the failed invasion and all maps showing the way to the Federation. Year 753, the discovery of the Nine Cities. The Ice Elven fleet discovers the planet and the inhabited platforms orbiting around it. The humans living on them, while not able to construct a ship capable of voidfaring, have no problem making vessels which take flight long enough to move between the platforms or to and from the planet. Their civilization turns out to be ancient. The true origin of the platforms and the mystery of their settling has never been solved. Year 812, the beginning of the Elven-Dwarven War. The Kaiser's forces, after a long and taxing campaign, manages to occupy Terra Nostra, the homeworld of the Dragon Dwarves. They do not manage, however, to quell the Dwarven resistance. A war erupts, which, its tides shifting from one side to the other, will continue for almost 600 years. Year 1104, the appearance of the City of Gnomes. A mysterious object appears on the orbit of one of the worlds of the Dominion. A city built entirely out of an unknown metal, shifting through space on its own. After exactly 7 days, it disappears, only to emerge a while later in a completely different spot in the universe. The gnomes inhabiting the city are unfriendly and distrustful at first. Over time, however, they become a race of traders, and their city the biggest market in the known universe. Year 1171, a turn in the Elven-Dwarven War. The Ice Elven Dominion, existing for 12 centuries, is slowly verging towards its downfall. An evident sign of that is the fact that the dwarves are gaining the upper hand in the war. They've managed to drive back the occupying forces from Terra Nostra and take the fight into the reaches of space. Soon, the fleet of the Dragon King celebrates its first victories, and the dwarves begin a campaign aimed at freeing other worlds from the thrall of the Dominion. Doing so, they establish the League of the Free, whose purpose is to bring down the Ice Elven Dominion. Year 1200, the Prophet's Speech. The ruler of Cardhuel, a world on the fringe of the universe, returns from exile, brought upon him by the Ice Elves occupying his world. He's terribly mutilated, his eyes having been gouged out and his right hand cut off, yet the lost limb is replaced by a crystal hand, an artifact of unimaginable power. Freeing his world from the rule of the Dominion, he begins to preach a doctrine which will become the foundation of the Church of the Crystal. This year is Year Zero, according to the Imperial calendar. Year 1223, the beginning of the Empire's expansion. After the Prophet's death, his grandson becomes Cardhuel's ruler. He puts into motion the prophet's ideal of bringing the teachings of the church to the farthest reaches of the universe. To this end, he establishes knights' orders and begins conquering nearby worlds, coupled with a forced conversion of their inhabitants to faith in the crystal. Thanks to the power of the living crystal, the Crystal Knights turns out to be unstoppable, and their domain expands at an astonishing rate. The prophet's grandson takes on the title of emperor and dubs his domain the Crystal Empire. Approximately year 1350, the second phase of the empire's expansion, the imperial conquests are starting to lose momentum, and each successive emperor mitigates the policy of border expansion. As a result, more worlds accept the faith in Crystal voluntarily, largely retaining their cultural diversity and overall autonomy. An especially vivid example of this policy are the Nine Cities, which nominally accept the Empire's sovereignty. In reality, however, this fact has no effect on their culture or politics. Year 1392, the rediscovery of Estonia. Dwarven travelers discover anew the forgotten route to Estonia. The Animal Men nation does not establish any contact, be it mercantile or diplomatic. Instead, it tightens its borders, sealing itself off from any foreign influence. Year 1448, the third phase of the Empire's expansion. The Emperor, having become enamored with the Nine Cities' culture, decides to move his capital there. Before he sets his plan in motion, however, he dies in mysterious circumstances. His death marks the date during which the Empire returns to its policy of annexation and representing other cultures. The rulers of the Nine Cities manage to keep their privileges by nothing short of a miracle. Year 1460, twilight of the Dominion. The Kaiser's fleet is ultimately defeated by the League of the Free during the Battle for Stars. In doing so, the Dwarven fleet paves a way to Alexandrion, the Dominion's capital. The Dragon King, however, decides not to make a final strike at the Ice Elves, instead opening peace talks. The defeated Kaiser is forced to recognize the liberated world's independence, retaining control over only a few worlds closest to Alexandrion. Year 1464, the Moon Dwarves Exodus. Princess Castellana II, the only Dwarven ruler free from the Dragon King's influence, breaks an age-long religious taboo, sending her first expeditions into the arborous moon orbiting Terra Nostra. Upon discovering it is habitable, she avoids recognizing the Dragon King's superiority, while gradually and secretly relocating her subjects to the moon. There she declares herself the ruler of the Sovereign Moon Kingdom, and her subordinates begin their war with the Dragon Kingdom. Year 1491, birth of Marco di Mirandello. In the City of Pillars, one of the Nine Cities, Marco di Mirandello is born. Fated to become a traveler, his memoirs will become one of the most popular sources of knowledge regarding the known universe, especially the mysterious Estonia. Year 1509, the first Crystal Crusade to Estonia. The Emperor makes an ill-fated decision to begin a crystal crusade aimed at subjugating Estonia, converting it to the Crystal Church. The Order of Earth leading it had some decent success at first. After a while, however, it met with heavy enemy resistance and was pushed back from the Federation's borders. Year 1511, the Second Crystal Crusade to Estonia. Furious because of the crusade's failure, the Emperor gathers a gigantic fleet over which he takes command personally and makes a second attempt at conquering Estonia. The crusade ends with the Empire's mysterious crushing defeat. Only a handful of survivors flee the Federation, relaying both the weird and mutually contradictory accounts of the massacre. Casualties of that battle include the heads of the Earth and Fire Orders, as well as the Emperor himself. The Empire also lost the Crystal Hand, the symbol of reign over the Empire. Year 1512. Civil war in the Empire. Left without the Emperor to look over them, the Orders began fighting for dominance over the Empire. The war lasts 5 years, crippling the already weakened Empire. Worlds left without the Order's supervision began to vie for independence, and the Crystal Church is losing its faithful at an alarming rate. After numerous bloody battles, the Order of Earth emerges on top. Its Grand Master decides, however, to not assume the title of Emperor. Year 1515, discovery of the new universe. Dwarven sailors, under the command of the Grand Admiral of the Dragon Kingdom himself, are the first in history to find a way to traverse the void surrounding the known universe and find new worlds on the other side. Their monopoly for travel across the Great Void is soon broken by the Moon Dwarves, and the conflict between the two factions moves to their colonies. I wish I had more timeline stuff, but that was all I was able to dig up. And no reviews for Crystallicum for the same reason I don't have a lot of the other information I wish I had. And that's a genuine bummer because I really like everything I was able to find this week. I also had zero luck finding an online resource for those looking to pick up a copy, which tells me you're going to need someone who reads Polish to figure it out, or it sounds like you're going to need to be in Europe with access to a local game shop. If you happen to have a source to find copies, hit me up with the info so I could share it with the masses, and I'll get the info out either on the socials, a future episode of the show, or a YouTube drop. However, I do think we're at a good point to bring today's tour to a close. In 2 weeks, we're going to break down three games that are basically interconnected: Tribate, DreamPod 9, and the Jovian Chronicles. Next week, however, this spot in the rotation goes to Bad GM's campaign Build Along, and we'll be building our group's first real adventure since we left off with them finally leaving home and making their way to the main continent. Not really sure what we're going to do with them yet, but I'm sure it's going to be interesting. Bad GM's campaign Build Along is available wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, badgmproductions.net. The theme music for Role-Playing History is Beyond New Horizons by Gioli Fazeri and is available from pixabay.com. Role-Playing History is a production of Bad GM Productions, and as you know by now, we've got a presence all over social media. So check out the info box for this episode or the website to see where you can follow us. In 2 weeks, we'll deep dive Tribe 8, DreamPod 9, and the Jovian Chronicles, but next week, it's going to be a new episode of Bad GM's Campaign Building Log. Until then, I'm Wayne Davis, and your Role-Playing History.